This is an ABC podcast.
This is the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, Isabella Pittaway with you for the Country Hour this Thursday. On the show today, farmers are at the centre of two pieces of federal legislation being debated in Canberra this week, the Future Drought Fund and new laws to deter on-farm trespass, laws which the Greens say are strong enough, but farmers and the federal government say could go further.
Well, I think those measures are fantastic, really, because at the moment, I understand there are minimal fines for trespass. And, yeah, really, it is just so easy to take things from a farm in many cases. So I think, the stricter those rules, the better off everyone will be.
And it could take some time to track down the source of listeria that's led to the deaths of two people. However, the Tasmanian government has confirmed the victims had all eaten Tasmanian smoked salmon, so we'll find out what that means for the industry a little later on. But first today, a group of citrus growers in South Australia have announced plans to break away from the peak lobby group Citrus Australia and will now advocate for themselves. Committee member of the new Citrus South Australia, Mark Dakey, says he hopes the group will be endorsed by the state government to manage funding.
For the last 7 years, we've been working under the national body. The look was seen to be unified to put the state body under the national body, and they've been managing our funding, and everything that we spend has to go through them. So it's like another layer of compliance, if you like, and that's how it's been. But sort of, we think we've matured now. We've become mature enough to go out on our own, so we've incorporated and we'll manage ourselves.
You sent the letter out to the growers announcing this on Sunday night. Has there been any backlash?
No, there's only been support, actually. The only calls I've had have been supportive, and emails that I've had have been supportive, so yeah, it's good.
How will this affect growers going forward?
We seek state government support, and growers going forward won't be affected. Are we still keep doing the things that we've always been doing, like we've been doing co-funding a bloke on the ground for doing fruit fly last season with stone fruit and with Perza. We do gall wasp. We've got a gall wasp project happening. We do the Adelaide show. We do field days. And we have a heavy interest in state water policy. And we do season opening stuff, like we went to Central Market a month or 6 weeks ago to launch the season opening. So we do quite a lot on the ground, and we're happy to do this work for SA growers, and with SA growers' interests are always at our heart.
All these things that you've been doing, have you been doing them with the old system, I guess you could call it, and it's just that the management is changing? Is that kind of the core difference here?
Yeah, well, when we were under the national body, anything we did had to be approved by them. So we think we're mature enough now to make our own decisions, and we've still got compliance with state government legislation, and we still have compliance. We still have to keep our growers happy, because once a year we have a regional forum and everything's on the table when we want to know what growers want us to spend their levies on. So there's no hidden agenda anywhere. It's all very open. So we didn't think we needed that extra layer of the national body compliance as well. And we're happy to continue working as we have worked, and we're also happy to work with the national body if they see fit to work with us.
Grower and committee member of the new Citrus South Australia, Mark Dakey. Meanwhile, Citrus Australia says the split will only cause problems for growers. Chairman Ben Cant says the bodies primarily disagree over how the levy funds should be spent.
We've been in discussion with the members, or the ex-members of that committee, for about 18 months, trying to resolve the situation, resolve any concerns that they had. And unfortunately, after an exhaustive effort, we weren't able to come up with a scenario in which we could satisfy the corporate governance requirements of Citrus Australia, being a national body, and the current committee members on that committee and their desires on how they wanted to run their committee.
So you were aware and almost expecting this breakaway?
Yeah, that's correct. We certainly worked very hard to try to stop it. But unfortunately, the members on that committee decided that there was a path they wanted to take involving forming a new group and incorporating it. And that was something that Citrus Australia as a company couldn't support.
The new group have expressed an intention to take over the financial management of the South Australian industry. What does that mean for Citrus Australia?
Yeah, presently there's between $160,000 and $180,000 collected in levies per annum. It's basically a dollar a tonne from all citrus grown in the South Australian state. So certainly there was a motivation by the group. They were previously, Citrus Australia was previously managing that and is obviously going to apply to the government to continue to manage those funds due to, I guess, a differing of opinion on how those funds should be managed for the growers of South Australia was probably the crux of where the issue started.
And aside from monetary aspects, in terms of political influence and sway within the national scheme of things, how will that play out with this group moving away from the national body?
Well, certainly for Citrus Australia, we're a member-based organisation and we're there to represent all of citrus growers in Australia, first and foremost our members, but also for the greater good of the citrus industry in Australia. Now, we lobby state, federal and international governments, and so I really fail to see how a small group of levy payers in South Australia can have any significant influence, given that citrus is predominantly an export-driven crop.
What sort of feedback have you had from growers since this split was announced?
It's certainly been very dividing in the industry, which is an unfortunate scenario. At this point in time, with recent fruit fly outbreaks, pending water issues, labour reforms, it's certainly a time where we should be working together. We've had many growers who have been extremely supportive of the national model, and it's our opinion that the vast majority of hectares of citrus grown are supportive of a national model.
So are you willing to work with the new group?
Well, I think it's still early days, and certainly we will always operate in the best interest of our members and the citrus industry. And certainly if any group's motivations and intentions are in sync with what we believe the best interests for the industry are, then we for certainly will work together. However, being a member-based organisation, we're not in the business of being members of other people's organisations. We're certainly, as a peak industry body, we're exactly that. We're the peak representing growers. So we will consult with other people to get what we believe is the most balanced opinion.
That's Chairman of Citrus Australia, Ben Cant, finishing that report by Grace Whiteside. And speaking of oranges, according to the Bureau of Statistics, South Australia produces the largest volume of oranges along with wine, carrots, onion and potato. Why am I telling you this? Well, we're going to have a little bit of fun on the Country Hour today. To join in, you'll have to head to either the ABC Rural Facebook page or my Twitter page, which is at Bella Pittaway, where you'll find a coloured graph with the states that produce the largest volume of a commodity. Now, here's the scenario. The apocalypse is here and you can only survive off of one state's biggest commodities. So which state do you choose and why? Text me on 0467 922 783. Personally, South Australia gets my vote because, well, wine. If you're going to see off the end of the world, might as well have some wine. But maybe you're a big meat eater and you'd like to have steak, so you'd have to pick Queensland then, because it produces the most beef, as well as avocados, strawberries and peanuts, to name a few. So head to the ABC Rural Facebook page or Twitter, take a look at the graph and tell me, if you had to live off the food each state produced the most of, where would you live and why? 0467 922 783. There's already quite a bit of debate going on about which state people would pick, and you'll probably have a bit of a chuckle at the ACT's list as well. Well, to dairy news now, and Australian dairy farmers say it will seek clarification from supermarket giant Aldi following a second round of price rises on milk in its stores. Aldi and Coles followed Woolworths in abolishing dollar per litre pricing on milk earlier this year. In a statement to the ABC, Aldi says the recent price rises were the direct result of the recent increase in the farmgate milk prices agreed between our milk suppliers and the dairy farmers. Aldi says it will continue to maintain the collection and distribution of 10 cents per litre implemented earlier this year and ensure the proceeds are passed on to dairy farmers in full. ABC Southwest reporter Anthony Pansia spoke with Australian dairy farmers and began by asking if the price hike had come as a surprise. He's speaking here with Ashley McKinnon.
We don't have much information at all about why they've had what looks like an additional increase. And so that extends to us also not knowing whether or not any of that additional increase will make its way back to dairy farmers. I mean, all we know is that they've commit from their statement is that they've committed to continue the current 10 cent pass-through. But we will be making further inquiries with Aldi to understand what their intentions are with this increase.
So it would be fair to say that this comes as a surprise to even Australian dairy farmers?
We were not aware before they made the announcement that they intended to do this, no.
Does ADF have a direct line of communication with Aldi?
We maintain collaborative relationships with retailers as we can, but we would always seek further engagement from that part of the supply chain, especially Aldi.
In its statement, Aldi have said that they will continue to maintain the collection and distribution of 10 cents per litre implemented earlier this year and ensure that the proceeds are passed on to dairy farmers in full.
It's comforting to know that Aldi Australia is providing certainty to farmers by committing to continue passing a 10 cent increase in its fresh milk products back to the farm gate. Supermarket discounting has had an incredibly demoralising and negative impact on the Australian dairy industry of the last 8 years. Now retailers are recognising that this pricing strategy must be fixed for the sake of the supply chain.
That's Australian dairy farmers spokesperson Ashley McKinnon speaking there with Anthony Pansia. Well, farmers have welcomed the news that supermarket Aldi has increased the price of its home brand milk. New South Wales South Coast dairy farmer Ian Zenstra says changes in the supermarket aisle is a good thing for all dairy farmers.
Well, it's a big move, and it's a major move because it has lifted the retail price of milk. And it's up to where the cheapest milk on the shelf should be, because most brands are about $1.50 or more, and they've had trouble competing with the home brand or the retailer brand milk. So it'll lift the whole bar, because they too have to lift, and no, they won't be competed away.
So which farmers will this affect directly?
Well, I think this is not a direct farmer issue. The 10 cents a litre from most of them went to the farmers that supplied that milk. I think this is a benefit to all farmers because it's lifting the value of milk, and all processors who are quite frankly struggling in this industry will be able to get more revenue and value for the milk, and that should flow through to the farmers. Everyone in the supply chain has to do well, and I'd like to see the processors do better and pass pricing through to farmers.
What about the significance of Aldi in this role, bringing up the price of their milk? We've often focused on Coles and Woolworths in discussions around dollar a litre milk, but what role do you think Aldi play in the scheme of things for dairy farmers?
Well, it's a big and principled move for Aldi, because they all like to compete amongst each other, and I hope this lifts the bar. Obviously, the 10 cent a litre did for Woolies and then Aldi and Coles. I hope this lifts the bar on milk pricing on the shelf and in the supply chain.
At the moment, we're still seeing processors increase their offer to farmers because the competition for milk is fierce at the moment. What are you seeing amongst dairy farmers that you speak to?
Well, prices are increasing in New South Wales. I think supply and demand has finally come into play. I think the processors and the retailers, and if we see the Coles move, some of it is to do with product security in this very competitive white milk, or in the milk market generally, especially in the Northern Victorian pool where milk was drawn from New South Wales and Queensland. So supply and demand is working. I think there's an understanding of the pressure on the supply pool, which I call farmers. It's very public, the economic stress upon farmers. So I think there's what you might say a political consideration or a consideration, but clearly there's a genuine understanding that farmers are needing more viability in milk.
What do you think are your priorities for any change or reform in the dairy industry as you're here at the New South Wales Farmers Conference? What would you like to put forward to see as a policies or change for the industry?
Well, I think the mandatory code is important, that we have a standard of fair play and principled relationships between farmer and processor. I think that sort of understanding that things are going to be better across the supply chain is impacting upon retailers as well. So I'd like to see that established, of course, and working properly. I think as well the sense that through leverage and publicity that the role and the somewhat strained role the retailer behaviour has put upon the supply chain had to change. And I see signs here that it is changing. The 10 cents was good. I'd have liked to have seen it be encompassed by overall improved milk payments to processors. And that's the very, very good thing about what Aldi is doing now. Clearly it's not going directly to the farmers, but stronger processes, more, you know, I'd say process of getting more out of the businesses, operating well means better prices to farmers, and especially at this time of price need for farmers. They haven't been really, I sense, and I was involved with dairy farmers, so I think I understand it, being able to pay money that they didn't have, and it's now it's coming through the retailers and the shelf.
That is dairy farmer Ian Zenstra speaking there to Josh Becker. And on the milk increase with Aldi, we've had a text through saying that milk being $1.10 is still not enough, given you have to pay $3 for a litre of water. Thanks for that comment. And on which state would you choose to live in if the apocalypse is here and you can only survive off one state's biggest commodities, which state do you choose? Well, online, Queensland and Victoria seem to be the most populous states. If you want to know what I'm talking about here, head to the ABC Rural Facebook page and you'll find a coloured graph that breaks down each state's, well, the commodities that it produces the most of. I've picked South Australia because I want to see the end of the world off with a glass of wine. But yes, Victoria and Queensland proving very popular. Rachel's saying Victoria for the dairy and the fruit. Luckily, I already live here. Second would be Queensland for the avocado. Another comment here saying, Queenslander, yes, the wine in South Australia was tempting, but you can make rum out of sugar, so what else do you need, really? Another comment here saying, Queensland for sure, I see not much comes out of the ACT. There's a laughing emoji after that because there is nothing listed for the ACT. They're not feeling the love there. A lot of people saying, gee, most of my favourite foods are in Queensland, so I have to go with Queensland. Let me know. Which state would you choose? Have a look at the commodities there. What can't you live without? 0467 922 783.
You're listening to the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, the recent round of Nuffield scholars are currently trekking the world investigating their different study topics. Ellen Litchfield from Wilperina Station near Maree has just finished the Global Focus Tour, which is with other Nuffield scholars looking at a wide range of industries. She will now head off on her individual study tour focusing on red meat production. She's been everywhere from Singapore to Texas and told Brooke Neindorf most industries she has seen, she's been able to relate to her own study.
So on my individual trip, I'm looking at the role of livestock production and how they affects and can help with climate change. And I guess what some of the things that really struck out was that climatic variability is a really big concern for everywhere, you know, all over the world. When we were in China, we saw they're doing a lot of things with air quality over there. So planting millions and hundreds of millions of trees across nearly all of the provinces that we visited. So that was really interesting. And I think the issue with climate change is what's sort of been evident at all the countries we've visited is it requires government support and the policy around that to allow the agricultural producers to address it. And I think although livestock production gets a lot of negative publicity because of their contribution to emissions, they are in a unique position in that, especially for rangeland where we are, there's the option that we can hopefully, with different management practices, try and increase the sequestration rates. So it's an industry that, although it does produce a lot of emissions, it at least has the option that it can try and help with the outcomes as well.
Were you surprised by some of the things that you've seen so far?
Yeah, we were there. I think, well, the tree planting in China was a surprise. They're really environmentally conscious, and there is a lot of push for more environmental sustainability. And then one of the other things that I guess is topical in Australia when I left as well that we noticed in Germany is that public perception of agriculture and the pressure that the German farmers, we visited a lot of pig farmers and poultry farmers, the public pressure that they are feeling. And yeah, that was really evident, especially in the European countries.
Now, Ellen, I was just having a look on your Instagram earlier, and you said about going to see that German beef farm, and that you're interested to see the impact that the Australian drought is having on cattle prices in Germany. What's the reason behind that?
So, because we have been selling so many like destocker cattle, it's been decreasing their beef prices in Germany, which was really interesting. And the other thing that I hadn't realised, which is a surprise in Germany, is that there's still a bull market. So their consumer still wants to eat, or their beef system is set up as for bulls. So in the they get really high growth rates, and I think that perhaps that's an area for education that you can get a product that might taste a little bit better if they're eating steers or heifers. But yeah, so they're still selling bulls.
Now, you're in the States at the moment, but you're heading off again very shortly to take part in your individual study tour?
Yes, yep. So I'm just finishing up in the States now, just organising some, it's been a really hectic 6 weeks, so just trying to organise and set up for the next sort of tours. So I'm going up to British Columbia in Canada. They've got a climate action initiative, and they've got some really interesting projects looking at rangeland management and water evaporation rate on the properties. So I'm hoping to catch up with some of the farmers working with that. And then I'm also going up to visit a fellow Nuffield scholar in Hudson's Hope, which is sort of northern British Columbia, that is has a similar topic looking at ensuring that environmental sustainability and trying to work out how the producer can get some recognition for results-based environmental projects. And so, for example, increasing the biodiversity within the property, and those sort of actions have benefits for the whole of society, and how you can get some recognition for that sort of work.
That's Ellen Litchfield, who is one of this year's Nuffield Scholars. She was speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. And turning now to the circus that is UK politics and the impact of Brexit on farmers, the new UK Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, will have a challenge settling the debate in his own parliament on how the nation will leave the European Union. But meanwhile, those working in agriculture policy are getting on with the job. Vicky Robinson is an environmental and agriculture policy advisor in England. She explained the effects of Brexit on the ag industry.
there's the policy side of things. So currently, majority of our policy in the agricultural industry is derived from the European Common Agricultural Policy, and that's now come to a domestic angle, assuming Brexit goes ahead as planned. So we've got a new Ag Bill and an Environmental Bill going through Parliament at the moment, and there are changes as to the way the farmers are supported from the way they currently are to the way they are planned in the future. So a move to delivery of payments for public goods is the plan. There's also the trade, but you know, what's agreed on the trading side of things will have huge implications, particularly for some of our export sectors, such as the lamb industry. And then, you know, there's other regulatory requirements that, you know, we currently under EU rule that will come into UK law, and depending on, you know, what happens with those will have an impact on the industry as well. So yeah, the agricultural industry is one, and the department I work for is one of the most heavily impacted with Brexit.
What's the mood of farmers around the Brexit talks?
I think there's a real mix. I think there are some who are quite, you know, optimistic, see it as, you know, sort of, you know, getting out of Europe and the rules that come with that. I think there's a lot of nervousness, and I think increasingly as sort of the uncertainties of, you know, a no-deal Brexit possibility, etc., and the implications that might have on the industry. Like everything is with Brexit, there's sort of everyone has different views and some people are in different camps on it.
But more importantly, Vicky, you're here at the Grain Growers Conference as a Nuffield Scholar from the UK. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're studying?
Yes, I'm looking at the importance of farmer-to-farmer knowledge exchange, so peer-to-peer learning, and in particular at times where businesses are changing through externalities that are outside of their control. So the context for me being new ag policy in the UK, but recognising that around the world there are a lot of challenges to the ag industry, you know, climate, for example, consumer trends. Over here in Australia, obviously climate's a big one, and also water availability is coming up a lot. It's, you know, looking at, you know, how important is it that for farmers to be sharing, you know, how they're adapting their business, what they're doing with each other. But interestingly, as well as the sort of technical aspect, there's a social aspect as that as well, a sort of well-being side of talking to each other that's coming out really quite strongly. So I'm over here working my way east to west across the country, never visited before and absolutely loving it, talking to individuals but also groups, farmer groups that are formed, and seeing, you know, the value that those farmers get from being in part of that group. Why are they in that group? And also it's about what actually affects a change in practice. So, you know, obviously farmers can share knowledge, but what I'm interested in is them actually then, you know, doing something different and changing a practice on the farm as a result of sharing that knowledge, because I feel that farmers are so innovative, and you give them a challenge, they rise to it, but they all might do it in a slightly different way. And I think that's what's so special about farmers, and it, how they share that and their, what they're doing is what I'm sort of looking at.
That's UK Nuffield Farming Scholar and Agriculture Policy Advisor Vicky Robinson speaking there with Simone Smith. It is just after 12:30 on the Country Hour, so let's find out what's making news headlines. It's good afternoon to Luke Radford.
Good afternoon, Isabella. A bill to repeal the Medivac legislation has passed the lower house of Parliament. The law gives doctors more power to decide whether asylum seekers on Nauru or Manus Island can be transferred to Australia for medical treatment. The government opposed the legislation when it passed earlier this year and made repealing it an election commitment. The Senate is not expected to vote on the repeal bill until after a parliamentary committee examines it. A shed containing cars, a caravan and boats has caught fire at Barmara this morning. CFS crews were called to the property on the Sturt Highway at about 8:15 after reports of smoke, flames and explosions caused by gas bottles. The Country Fire Service says a member of the public suffered minor burns and took themselves to hospital for treatment. And a search has been launched to find the oldest building in South Australia that isn't currently heritage listed. Heritage South Australia says it's looking for hidden gems that may have escaped the public eye. A spokesperson says people should keep an open mind about what buildings might fit the bill. And we'll have more ABC News at 1:00.
And Luke, before you go, we've been talking about this graph that's up on the ABC Rural Facebook page that shows the Australian states that produce the largest volume of particular commodities in South Australia. That's orange, wine, carrot, onion and potatoes. And in Western Australia, it's all cropping. It's barley, oats, wheat and canola. I'm asking people today, if you had to live off the food each state produced the most of, where would you live and why? Where is it for you, Luke?
Oh, I flirted with being a traitor and deserting to Queensland, because the idea of avocado, sugar, banana, pineapple and beef was really hard to sort of pass off on. But at the end of the day, I got to stick true to my roots, and I like cooking, and as a result, I deal with onion a ridiculous amount, so it's SA all the way for me.
And you're okay that there's no animal protein in South Australia?
Carrot, onion, potato. Should be right. Got wine to wash it down with.
What else do you need? That sounds great. All righty. Thanks, Luke. Luke Radford with the headlines there. You can let me know. Luke's picked South Australia. I've also picked South Australia. I'd love to hear from you. 0467 922 783. Have a look at that graph and tell me, if you had to live off the food each state produced the most of, where would you live and why? It's looking pretty good for Queensland and Victoria. Another comment here saying, I'd go to Western Australia because I could eat pasta every day. And yes, the list for Western Australia has wheat, barley, oats and canola. So if you like carbs, you're pretty well set. Let's head off to the Weather Bureau now, where it's good afternoon to Mark Analak. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you going?
I'm all right. Mark, what's happening with the weather today?
Well, at the moment, there's not too much going on. There's a high-pressure system sort of east of us at the moment. So South Australia is experiencing light northerly winds through most of the parts of the state. However, there is a frontal system moving up from the southwest, and ahead of that, there's quite a bit of high-level cloud we can see moving across South Australia. That front is expected to sweep across the southern agricultural area during tomorrow. And with that, we'll see an increase in shower activity, particularly across the southern agricultural area, and possibly reaching into the far southern parts of the pastoral districts by the end of the day. But there won't be too much pushing in sort of too far north. Generally, rainfall figures tomorrow, probably only looking at a few millimetres with this system as it sweeps across the south. But there is the potential for a rumble of thunder as well, particularly over the northern Mount Lofty ranges, the Murraylands and the Riverland districts as well during the afternoon. So just the tail end of the front through tomorrow, producing a few millimetres of rain. As we move into Saturday, the morning will start off quite cool, areas of frost, particularly on and east of the ranges, but quite extensive areas of fog forecast for Saturday morning. And that's ahead of another system which is expected to make its way across the western border late on Sunday. So at this stage, Saturday looks like it'll be fine, apart from the early morning fog and frost. The day will be fine itself. And also starting on Sunday, again, cool on and east of the ranges to start with early morning fog and frost. But as the day progresses, we'll see these northerly winds start to freshen and warmer conditions through the day, ahead of a band of sort of cloud and rain moving across the western border during the afternoon. So for Sunday, areas of rain moving into sort of west of Spencer Gulf by the end of the day, maybe a shower or two pushing as far east as the eastern border districts by the end of Sunday. For central and eastern parts of the state, we'll probably have to wait until Monday. That band will continue to move eastwards, so we're likely to see areas of rainfall across agricultural areas and even the southern parts of the pastoral districts during Monday, and it will gradually ease back and contract eastwards during the day on Monday, so that by Monday night we will have seen the last of the rain band. Moving in behind it, a high pressure system will move into the Bight very quickly. The winds turn southerly across South Australia, so for the middle part of next week, it looks like we'll be under the influence of cooler conditions and some onshore shower activity pushing up over southern coast, but mostly sort of the agricultural areas, but mostly over the southern coasts during the mid part of next week. Overall, the rainfall totals between now and Monday night, I guess most of the rainfall, apart from the 2 or 3 millimetres tomorrow's system will bring, most of the rainfall is expected during Sunday, Monday's rain band as it moves across the state. So in total, we're looking at variable figures, I guess, generally 2 to 5 millimetres, increasing to 5 to 20 millimetres over most of the agricultural area. Falls of 20 to 40 millimetres are possible about the Mount Lofty ranges, probably the mid-north Murraylands, upper southeast district. It looks like the band will move north of the lower southeast, so we're sort of talking about the higher figures north of the lower southeast. But for the northern parts of the state, we're not expecting any in the far northeast, but for the rest of the pastoral districts, less than a couple of millimetres as this system moves across. So all in all, today will be fine for the rest of today, but the weak system coming through tomorrow, producing a couple of millimetres of rain for agricultural areas, and then another fine day for Saturday, well, mostly fine day for Saturday, ahead of what looks like a decent rain band to move across the state, producing some good rainfall through Sunday and into Monday. This has been Mark Analak at the Weather Bureau.
Looking forward to that, Mark. That's Mark Analak at the Weather Bureau. Thanks, Mark. Let's go to the far west of New South Wales now for your weather. Partly cloudy with overnight temperatures falling to between 4 and 8, with daytime temperatures reaching the low 20s. For the lower western district, a cloudy day with a slight chance of a shower near the Victorian border in the afternoon and evening, a near zero chance of rain elsewhere. Overnight temperatures falling to between 4 and 8, with daytime temperatures reaching between 17 and 20 degrees. Now, earlier we were talking about a group of citrus growers in South Australia that have announced plans to break away from the peak lobby group Citrus Australia and to advocate now for themselves. Well, some text through on that. A citrus grower at Wakery says this group is not a breakaway, only an incorporation of the same committee. This would allow and ensure SA levy payers spending funds are decided on by SA levy payers, not the Citrus Australia board made up of interstate representation. The incorporated SA committee is still wanting to work alongside Citrus Australia in the best interest of the industry. Thanks for that text. And another one here saying if SA citrus growers are so supportive of Citrus Australia, why are only 25 of the state's 250 odd grower members of the national company? Not sure about the stats there, but thank you for that. Thank you for that point. 0467 922 783. If you want to get in touch on any of today's stories, or if you'd like to join the conversation about which state you'd choose to live off the food that it produces the most of, 0467 922 783. Well, it could take some time to track down the source of listeria that's led to the deaths of two people. However, the Tasmanian government has confirmed the victims had all eaten Tasmanian smoked salmon. A person in their 70s from New South Wales and another from Victoria have died. A third person in Queensland is recovering from the infection. Fiona Breen looks at just how difficult it is to track down the source of the bacteria, particularly as the cases have occurred months apart.
Tasmania's Director of Public Health, Mark Veitch, spoke to Leon Compton about the testing regime.
We knew about this in the first place because we have really good surveillance now for listeria infections. There have been 27 listeria infections in Australia in the first half of this year, which is actually fewer than we've had in the first half of the year for about 10 years. However, we have very good ways of fingerprinting the strains of the listeria bacteria that these people have. And after a case that occurred in early June was diagnosed and tested, it became clear that there were three isolates of listeria, three cases that had much the same fingerprint. And these were in February, May and June. So the foodborne disease investigators in the jurisdictions where the cases were went back to try and find out if there was something in common between all these cases. And what they found is that all three cases had eaten one or another form of smoked salmon. The next part of the investigation involves trying to work out which brand or which brands of smoked salmon they ate. And this can be quite difficult because, as you can imagine, if you're asking for detailed information about food consumption perhaps months ago and including people who've died, it's actually quite difficult to get verified information about that. So that's the problem that faces the investigators in the jurisdictions, is that the events are becoming quite distant now, and it may be that we're unable to get precise accounts of the particular salmons that each person ate.
Linda Bookman from the Food and Safety Council told Pia Wursu, listeria is everywhere. However, she said getting sick from it is rare, but it's always a risk for the elderly, pregnant mothers, or people with compromised immune systems.
So listeria is out there in the environment. It's in the soil. It's on people's hands. So you tend to find it in food that won't be cooked again, but has been handled quite a lot. So, cold meat from the deli, soft cheeses most people are aware of. But even last year there was some deaths linked to rock melon, which has now been added to the list. Also pre-prepared fruit and veggie salads, so don't have them from buffets or salad bars, or even bagged lettuce too that you see. But there's lots of alternatives you can do. You can prepare your own salad, you can prepare your own cold meat, or you can cook any of those foods. So if you pop your smoked salmon onto a pizza or warm it up to quite warm in with some pasta, then of course that will kill any bacteria on the outside.
Tasmania's Premier Will Hodgman has confirmed the major salmon companies have been cleared of any food safety law breaches. Even so, they'll conduct a review of food safety standards involving salmon processing in Tasmania.
First and foremost, obviously, I would extend the state's regrets at deaths that have occurred. Secondly, and most importantly, I'm advised that Tasmania's salmon processes have been investigated by our Department of Primary Industries, Water and the Environment. The Public Health Officer has also been involved to assure Tasmanians and the suppliers and indeed the recipients of Tasmanian salmon as to the quality of that product. I'm advised that the investigations have determined that there have been no breaches of national health standards by Tasmanian companies, and obviously these matters will be further investigated by not only our authorities but indeed interstate and national bodies as well. But the advice I have is very clear in that there's been no breach by national standards by Tasmanian businesses, and of course very high standards are set and expected by our businesses, particularly in the production of products such as these.
Tasmania's three big salmon producers, Tassal, Huon and Petuna, have all said daily testing has shown no abnormal levels of listeria and there's no need for a product recall.
Fiona Breen with that report.
Direct hit, driven powerfully.
The Women's Ashes is just a tap away on the ABC Listen app.
For six.
Every match, across every format, live and called by the best in the game.
Wicked for Australia.
Uninterrupted, in depth, in the palm of your hand.
And no hesitation.
Pulled in the air, caught it short mid-wicket.
The Women's Ashes, streaming live on the ABC Listen app.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill, this is the South Australian Country Hour.
Well, it is 13 minutes to one. My name's Isabella Pittaway. Well, farmers are at the centre of two pieces of federal legislation being debated in Canberra this week. The first, the Future Drought Fund, would rebadge an infrastructure fund to provide $100 million a year from next year to prepare for drought. The other would see new laws to deter on-farm trespass. The Greens don't agree with either. Reporter Kath Sullivan asked the party's agriculture spokesperson, Senator Janet Rice, why, beginning with the drought fund.
The Greens absolutely want to support farmers who are struggling with drought, want to support our agricultural industries that are struggling with drought, but it means actually having a fund that's consistent with acknowledging that our climate crisis is overall what's driving the increase and worsening drought in our country. And it's got to be, and any fund that's responding to that has got to be well managed.
In the Senate, you proposed an amendment that would acknowledge the role that companies that burn fossil fuels have, or mining industries have, on droughts here in Australia. And that led to Senator Pauline Hanson actually asking the government if it had any evidence of the impact that Australian mining has had on the current drought, or perhaps any drought that we've had, to which the government actually responded by saying, no, there's no proof of that.
Which is just total denial. I mean, we know that climate change is caused by the pollution from the burning of coal, gas and oil right across the world, and that Australia is a massive player in that. Our emissions are the highest per person of any country, and we are the biggest exporter of coal, the biggest exporter of gas. So if Australia is going to be dealing with our drought crisis, we have to be dealing with our climate crisis, and we've got a really big role that we can play. In particular, what we were proposing today was that rather than establishing this drought fund by pulling money out of transport infrastructure, ripping money out of, you know...
I'll just pull you up on that, because the government would say this is a dormant fund sitting there gathering dust, and it's not actually...
It's their choice for it to be a dormant
funding.
It's their choice for it to be a dormant fund. They haven't chosen to take money out of it. But regardless, we're saying that, look, the money for tackling our drought crisis, it's really appropriate for it to come from the companies that are actually benefiting from the burning and the mining and the export of fossil fuels.
And specifically, I think it was 10%?
Essentially, what we're saying is there should be a floor on the profits, of a tax on the profits of the oil and gas companies. So if they are extracting oil and gas, they're making profits out of that, that there should be a minimum 10% of those profits that should be paid as a royalty. The Parliamentary Budget Office had estimated for us that would raise $4.9 billion over 2 years. And that, we felt, would be a really appropriate money to base this drought fund on.
Away from drought funding, Senator Janet Rice, could you just be clear about what your party thinks about people breaking into farms to protest against traditional farm production?
Look, the Greens support civil disobedience and for people to have the right to protest against unfair and poor practices and poor laws. And in fact, there's so much change in our society that's only come because people have stood up and have participated in civil disobedience. We obviously, in the issue of trespass on farms, there are laws against trespass. And so anyone who's doing that knows that they would expect to be charged, and they should be charged with trespass. And then it's up to the courts to decide whether their rationale for that trespass is reasonable if there were extenuating circumstances. So, for example, if they are trespassing a farm where it's known that there is, you know, really poor practices, animal cruelty that's going on. Obviously, it doesn't happen. Most farms, that's not what's going on. But you've got to actually allow sort of people to be able to call out really bad practice.
And can't they do that legally?
And illegal operations. It's often very difficult to do that legally if you can't actually sort of have the evidence. And, you know, we know that people have been appalled about, you know, what's been going on with live sheep exports, of the cruelty to poultry in some poultry farming operations. And that has occurred because people have actually had to break the law to collect that evidence. But, you know, we certainly feel that if people are trespassing, we've got laws against trespass that, yes, we accept should be applied. And one of our biggest concerns with these new laws is that they're really making the penalties for that trespass really quite extreme.
I think it's fair to say there's genuine fear spreading across the country that people who are doing the right thing may have their property broken into, their homes broken into.
If you're a farmer operating as most farmers do, with, you know, sensitively, sustainably not mistreating your animals, well then, yes, it is not reasonable at all to be worried and fearful that somebody is going to come and invade your farm. But in dealing with that fear, it doesn't mean that we should be really cracking down to be unreasonably cracking down on genuine civil disobedience, where you've got people that have got a good expectation or a reasonable expectation that there is a cruel practices going on. We've got to have a balance with that. And what we currently think is, in fact, the existing laws, they strike that balance.
That's Senator Janet Rice, and the government's proposed new anti-trespass laws are expected to come up for debate soon. Staying on trespass, earlier this week, the New South Wales government announced it will introduce the toughest laws in the country targeting animal activists, including trespassers receiving on-the-spot fines from $1,000. Here in South Australia, the state government is also in the process of introducing new trespass laws. Now, last month, equipment and a shed were torched at a dairy farm near Two Wells, and farmer Mike Barema was concerned that it could be the work of animal activists. The police are yet to determine who was responsible. I spoke to Mr. Barema earlier.
Basically, someone drove in and then dropped a petrol bomb and lit a fire under the back of a telehandler. And that was only about 50 metres inside the property. And then that fire took hold and totally destroyed the telehandler. and that's used to prepare the feed mix for the cows. Well, it's actually used to do everything, remove manure and to push to grade feed up to the cows so they regularly get fresh feed put in front of them. That fire then moved into a barn and totally destroyed that and some dairying equipment that was inside that barn and some food.
And you mentioned before police aren't sure who has done this. I mean, at the time, did you suspect that it was animal activists? Was there anything that led you to that suspicion?
Well, only that we had had previously, we have had gates opened inexplicably and, gates that were actually quite difficult to manually open were found to be open. And that was all. And the fact is we're published on an animal activist map, which sort of implies that we are cruel to animals. You know, that we're a factory farm, really, I suppose, is what it comes down to. And, they're the two reasons. Yeah.
Activists coming onto farms, how much of a concern is that to you?
Oh, it's a major concern. Because, we'll say with the gates being left open, in that particular case, see, our cows have got the option of staying in a barn, in a massive covered shed. They can either be in the paddock or they can stay in the barn. Well, if those animals had walked out, you know, as it is, often, depending on the temperature, the weather or so, the cows prefer to stay in the barn rather than go outside. But had these cows, the gate was probably open around midnight or whatever, had these cows walked out on the road, then, they're black and white and some are quite black. It's quite feasible for someone to actually not see them on the road and to actually to run into them. So it could easily have caused a car accident.
There's been a lot of talk about trespass laws and the federal government's laws, which people have said have been targeting animal activists. New South Wales is set to introduce the toughest laws in the country targeting animal activists, and they include on-the-spot fines and other financial penalties worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. We also heard this week that the South Australian government is also in the process of introducing laws for trespass. What do you think that the government should be doing?
Well, I think those measures are fantastic, really, because at the moment, I understand there are minimal fines for trespass, and on the average farm, it's very hard to protect your assets or your animals. You know, it's just the nature of farming that there are invariably gates left open. You know, there isn't high security, really, on most farms. And so you need to have severe penalties for someone who is inexplicably found on your farm. And, really, it is just so easy to take things from a farm in many cases. So I think, the stricter those rules, the better off everyone will be.
So I think in New South Wales, it's on-the-spot trespassing fines of $1,000 and biosecurity fines of up to $220,000 per person. Do you think that should be brought into South Australia, and is that enough to deter trespassers?
Yeah, I think that's fantastic, and that should definitely deter trespassers. And the other thing is the federal government introducing laws to penalise people for actually inciting other people to trespass. I think that's pretty significant. That'll be a real bonus too.
And what do you say to, concerns that have been raised that activists can also shine light on those occasions that people are doing the wrong thing and that they are needed as part of society?
Yes, I guess, that's probably a valid point. I mean, we do have the RSPCA that fulfills that role. So I think often blatant acts of cruelty are notified. Well, now they're generally notified to the RSPCA, and the RSPCA investigates. And I think every animal industry is trying its best to manage animal welfare to its best ability, because in the end, good animal welfare results in good economic outcomes.
That was Minco North dairy farmer Mike Bremer. And on this issue around the trespass laws, we've heard from a farmer, and earlier we heard from Green Senator Janet Rice. We've had a text in off of that interview saying that farmers can't survive unless they do their job properly, stop making excuses for vegans. And also on the other topic we've been talking about today, and that is the rural apocalypse, and which state would you choose to live on based on the largest volume of commodities that they produce. So South Australia, that was orange, wine, carrot, onion and potato. There's a graph up on the ABC Rural Facebook page if you want to check that out. John texted in to say South Australia because we produce lots of barley, which makes beer. It's true, we do produce lots of barley, but the you might have to head over to Western Australia. They're listed with the largest volume of that commodity, along with oats, wheat and canola. That is all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Do enjoy the rest of your Thursday, and we'll be back with you tomorrow. News time, 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.